Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Sectors Editor Harriet Russell. How are you doing, Harriet?
Yeah, good, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Deputy Companies Editor, soon to be Companies Editor, Mark Robinson. How are you, Mark?
It's out there now, John.
It's out there.
I put it out there. I'm very well, thank you.
Indeed. Companies Editor Ian Smith is off to the FT, but... There you go. This is the natural progression of things here in the FT
room. Is it natural?
Well, it's a little bit unnatural, but...
Is it a progression?
But it is the way it is, Robert. You are a company's editor in waiting, so you're going to be talking us through the many results we've had this week.
Ah, yes.
It's getting busy, isn't it?
It is getting rather busy.
You've picked up the mantle at just the right time.
Indeed.
So this week, we are going to talk mainly about results, actually, because, as I say, there are quite a few... And quite a few of those results fall into your sector, Harriet.
They do.
Let's quickly run through some of the big stories this week, some of which aren't in the magazine because the world has been moving fast. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe.
Indeed. Well, it's sort of apt, really, because of this week's feature featuring Country Risk, Political Risk by Alex Newman, who unfortunately isn't with us today.
Where is he now?
Actually, he's in. He did tell me.
Has he gone somewhere exotic?
He has gone somewhere exotic, but it's escaped me. I will come back to you on that point.
Indeed. So the cover feature this week is the rough guide to risk, and it's about actually how you actually try and manage the risk of venturing overseas. Which, if you're interested in above average returns, you should probably consider doing. But stories like Zimbabwe and Venezuela are quite frightening.
Well, yes, of course, and I think we've made this point in the past as well. It's odd, really, but when you talk about the extractive industries, mining and oil and gas
which Alex does in the feature quite a bit.
Indeed, and very often you'll find those are in political hotspots or unstable political areas. I mean, all of our readers would probably be well aware of this. And of course, if you've got investments in some of the London-listed companies that operate in South Africa, that's an overarching concern as well, because the political situation there is actually deteriorating in terms of Western companies, I would say.
Indeed. But so basically the point of the feature is that you shouldn't avoid these jurisdictions altogether, but what Alex is trying to do is make life a little bit more certain, how you can actually bring some certainty to the process of investing in these kind of off the beaten track jurisdictions.
Yes, I'd say so. I mean, I don't know if he mentions Zimbabwe or Robert Mugabe.
He hasn't actually,
because the last investor that I seem to remember targeting that country was Nicholas von Hoogstraden, the slum landlord.
How did he get on?
We haven't heard from him for a while.
I mean, Alex does give some very specific examples. A lot of them are mining, as you would expect. But actually, I think a really interesting point is that where this kind of country risk has come to a head, you've often been able to pick up assets on the cheap because people get overly pessimistic.
True. I mean, at the end of the day, money talks as well. But you've got a situation in South Africa, I alluded to before, where you have this effectively a schism within the ANC, where hardliners want to... repatriate a lot of South African industry, as was the case in Zimbabwe as well. And we all know what deleterious effects that had on the economy.
Indeed. One of the interesting things Alex has done here is understand how you can balance the risk with the potential rewards you can make. And actually, the chart he's put together, the table he's put together, which I think is fantastic, shows that the jurisdiction, which in the world is looking cheapest at the moment, is the UK.
Yeah.
And this actually echoes something John Barron wrote about last week, largely to do, I would suspect, with the political risk that is attached to Brexit.
Well, the perceived political risk...
But that's the point, perceived.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to think from an economic point of view that rationalism tends to take over in the last stages of any negotiation like Brexit as well, and I'm still confident that will be the case.
Indeed. But the point is that pessimism often leads to overselling. As it were. And the UK is certainly an example at the moment. Europe was last year, which is the subject of the big theme this week, the buying the European bounce back. So it's an interesting feature, and you know, especially for those investors of a more adventurous mindset.
Indeed. And I made the point in last week's Taking Stock. In fact, I've made it a couple of times in recent weeks that we're all expecting a general pullback in the market. So our readers should be girding their loins for some value opportunities that... coming in the weeks and months ahead.
Indeed. I mean, looking at the 7 days, and of course we didn't mention Venezuela there, which is the other big geopolitical news of the week, defaulting on their sovereign debts, which is...
Well, there's also all sorts of problems with regards to Venezuela as well, not least of which is the poor quality of their crude oil, which becomes an issue as Western markets move away from conventional motor vehicles. But that's down the road there. But it's a function of the crude over there that unless oil is somewhere in the region of $80 a barrel plus, they lose money.
And that's the processing cost of turning it into something that's usable.
Yes, it's very heavy. It's very heavy crude they've got over there, and it always has been the case, unfortunately.
Oil has had a good run this year, not so good this week. It's been falling back.
Yes, it has a little bit there, but there's so many levers with the oil price at the moment. Very few of them actually have to do with standard supply and demand as well. People are looking at the political situation in Saudi Arabia, obviously, as a key determinant there. We don't know exactly what's playing out. There's obviously some kind of power grab underway there. But what that means for the long-term oil price is difficult to say.
Indeed. Sticking with the 7 days page and the kind of big stories of the week, Tesco, Harriet. I mean, they've got clearance for the Booker deal. Yeah, it all seemed quite easy in the end.
It really did. There was sort of a hint a month or so ago, maybe 6 weeks now, that the competition stuff was really starting to intensify and that the CMA might make them do serious disposals as part of the terms and conditions of the deal. Anyway, that seems to have come to nothing. It's
indeed. I mean, because it was the convenience side of the business that the worries were mainly set, the competition worries were mainly
Londis centered. Londis and a few other...
Do they do Londis?
Booker owns Londis and Budgens, and Tesco obviously has its own extensive convenience chain.
Yeah, I think Booker has something called Premier as well, which I see.
Yeah, I think it does. And it's also obviously got Macro, the German business as well.
So what was the potential problem there, or the conflict?
The conflict was that I think other people or other sort of companies in the market said that they were worried that the convenience chains of Booker and Tesco overlapped too much in market share terms, that as a combined entity, they would exert significant pricing power.
Yeah.
But convenience has always been massively fragmented. And even together, I think this was ultimately what the CMA based their decision on. Their combined share is still quite small.
Yeah, and also I think it might have been slightly hypocritical for them to deny it based on the fact that they allowed McCall's about 18 months ago, maybe even 2 years now, to buy 278 co-op stores, adding to their own already extensive store estate. So
because they're now converting a lot of old McCall stores to a co-op format.
Yeah, so I think it's one of those things where they came out yesterday with actually a sort of cemented figure that no one can argue with, which is that Booker's market share being less than 20% means that there is no substantial conflict for them to have long-term concerns.
Mm. So they completely ignored the idea that a group that had massive market share in supermarket retail and significant market share in food service coming together might actually have some impact on prices.
Yep.
Just didn't matter to them at all.
It doesn't seem to have come to anything.
You saw the email I sent you, which was not my words, the words of an analyst.
The words of an analyst.
Shawcap.
Shawcap. It's Clive Black, who we refer to him as Mr. Supermarkets because he does have extensive knowledge.
Love Clive Black.
He's very, very good. And he referred to it as the comedy markets authority.
We've discussed this on this podcast before because things that you would think they would have no interest in, they seem to do, and things that seem quite significant seem to get waved through.
Yeah, well, one of the famous quotes at the beginning of the year when the deal was announced in January was the competition authorities are going to have a field day with this. Well, it seems like they have because they've had 11 months to sort of play around with it and they've done absolutely nothing about it.
Well, they've looked at some stuff.
Well, yeah, but in terms of final conclusions, they really haven't made any that are going to have to require serious action.
I really like Booker as a share, always have. I really like Charles Wilson as chief exec, which I think I've mentioned many times before.
Well, this is,
what do we think about the implication for Tesco now this is going through? Has it changed our view on the shares?
Not really. I think we've agreed, haven't we, that for Tesco, the biggest coup from this deal is actually getting Charles Wilson onto the board there. And I think that will serve them well. He's an industry veteran at this point and he really knows his stuff. Tesco, for me, the shares, it's not that I'm sort of disbelieving in the long-term kind of margin recovery there. It's just that I think the shares have priced it in the whole time that this recovery has been ongoing, and that hasn't really changed. It's come off slightly in the last 6 months while these competition issues were sort of lurking in the background.
Good bounce back this week, though. Looking at the rise and falls on the seven-day page, I think they're about, 7%?
Yeah, they were. That was in 1 day. That was on the back of the announcement.
Yeah, I think this is really great. I've always said I like this deal, and you know, I'm not generally a big fan of stupidly large mergers, but I really like the look of this one. I think it's clever.
It's really clever when you set it in context against the Amazon threat, which is something that I sort of alluded to in this week's Sainsbury's results as well.
Let's talk about Sainsbury's. Let's move swiftly into results. We'll come back to news, Robbo, because I know that you wrote the lead story in the news section this week was about Ultra Electronics, which was a horror. But so we'll come back to that. Let's keep on theme. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the Sainsbury's results.
Yeah, these were interesting. For me, they were kind of like,
oh God, that's a horrible graph.
Yeah. It is a bit of a stinker. But I think generally speaking with Sainsbury's, it takes a bit of time to kind of pull apart the meat, so to speak, which is that obviously since its Argos acquisition, the numbers have kind of been all over the place.
Which you would expect.
And they take a little bit of dissection to truly understand sort of the underlying health of the business, which actually, when you look at online and you look at convenience, really isn't that bad. It's traditional supermarket, which is kind of, you know, superstore level, which is not doing so well for them. But that is a trend across the industry, I would say. The demise of the weekly food shop, etc.
We still do our weekly food shop with Sainsbury's, but online.
Online, exactly. Which is an ever-evolving trend. And obviously, they have recognised this, and it'll be interesting to see how much the Argos acquisition, it's definitely driving an improvement at the top line, but analysts, particularly with supermarkets, are obsessed with like-for-like. So the like-for-like kind of looks modest because it excludes, obviously, a lot of the Argos impact.
Why have the shares come off so much over the past, 6 months?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's got to do with the Amazon Prime launch, which was the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. That ties in pretty much spot on with when the shares started to collapse.
But you haven't seen that level of underperformance from Morrison and Tesco. Is that because they're coming from a much weaker base?
Yeah, I genuinely do think that is it. Sainsbury's was never in as bad a way, and it's always had this kind of comfortable dividend yield to keep people sort of relatively interested. So for me, it was almost, I think I actually pitched it this year to our tips editor as an old reliable, strangely, because even though the industry faces massive challenges, it's very good at plugging away, hence the headline on this week's results.
I still like Sainsbury's as a business. I have to say, convenience was always talked about as the kind of alternative to the weekly shop where you go and do your top-up shopping. I still do my top-up shopping in a large supermarket, which is Tesco. Mm-hmm. And what I have noticed going in there is they seem to be getting their home ranges really right. Really
so Sainsbury's, right. I have to say.
Well, I haven't seen them because I don't go in there.
Well,
and
the biggest superstore next to me is a Sainsbury's. And I agree with you, like the general ranges there are doing so well. And you can tell it's real quality. And the food, I mean, the food is sort of as it ever was. But I think, yeah, it's difficult to know, really. I think online is just going to be the future. This is sort of a wider kind of topic that we need to look at.
But it sort of makes it harder to cross-sell. It makes it harder to promote that impulse purchase.
Well, and this is what I mean about it will be interesting to see how the Argos deal unfolds, because, of course, a lot of the motivation for that deal, aside from the distribution network, was the opportunity to cross-sell within store, as in people come and collect their Argos purchase, realise they're in a Sainsbury's superstore, and inevitably end up shopping for food or general merchandise while they're there.
I go in for some bread and I come away with half a dozen pillows.
Yeah, well, maybe it's working then. But
at Tesco.
Yeah.
At Tesco.
Maybe it's something that can translate, but I think Sainsbury's might struggle if the weekly food shop falls away. I think there is this thinking in people's minds of, I've got to go to the supermarket, so I'll arrange for my Argos delivery to be there at the same time, and then you might chuck in some extras that I hadn't thought about. And I think it's very difficult to think, is Argos enough of a draw without the weekly shop attached to it in order to manifest that cross-selling?
In my view, no.
I agree.
But there you go. Let's stick with the same page. Enough about supermarkets. Burberry. Mm. Now, this is interesting. Burberry, it's had a good run, actually. Not so much in the last week or so.
No, because the run that it's had this last year has largely been driven by a huge currency tailwind. It's obviously a very global business and earns a significant amount of revenue outside of the UK. So translating those revenues back into pounds has sort of done it quite a lot of good over the last year. However, what has emerged in the last week or two are a number of kind of strategic and underlying issues which they're going to have to fix, the biggest being the departure imminently of Christopher Bailey.
Is that such a bad thing? Because presumably there is a lot of talent out there in the world of fashion. He's had a good run. He's been done an amazing job for Burberry. But you know, talent gets stale.
Yeah, he's been at the group since 2001. He's been head of design since 2004.
Chief exec for a little bit as well, which didn't work out so well.
No, so in 2004, when he became head of design, he was alongside Angela Arendt as chief executive, and that was really a dream partnership.
And she's now at Apple.
She's now at Apple. And when she left, they promoted him into the joint role of chief executive and design, which is a bit unprecedented for this kind of business.
I think that was a very silly move.
And suffice to say...
I think we said so at the time, and so it's proved.
Yeah.
So tell us about the new guy.
The new guy...
Because you like the sound of this guy.
Yeah, so the new chief executive, they announced his appointment last year and he started this July. It's Marco Gobbetti, who came from Celine, which is a Parisian fashion house.
Oh, I know it well. I don't.
I admire it well, put it that way. And his chief designer there is a woman called Phoebe Philo, who's also British, incidentally. And between the two of them, they have completely revived that house. It was pretty much in administration when the two of them got there. And together, it's now one of the best performers. I think it's owned by Kering, as opposed to LVMH. And so anyway, he has been poached from Celine to come and head up Burberry. And
is he going
to
poach his design chief?
I have put her name in the results, put it that way. Because
is that a rumour you've heard?
It's a rumour I've heard. Yeah. The other name in the mix is Sarah Burton, who is currently head of design at Alexander McQueen and also designed the Duchess of Cambridge's wedding dress, if that puts it in perspective.
Yeah, I remember it well. It was a beautiful thing.
It was beautiful. But Phoebe Philo, I think, you know, she's an industry veteran as well and has had an extensive career. She was at Chloe before that. So she knows her stuff. And the two of them could try and make the same magic happen. It's difficult because Phoebe Philo is still answering to a conglomerate and Marco Gobbetti is not. Burberry is not owned by anyone except Burberry. So it's a very different kind of existence. We'll see.
But interesting, but Marco Gobbetti has some ideas which he's laid out, which you've mentioned in the news piece. One of which I thought was really interesting. You were talking about looks rather than like items.
Complete looks.
Complete. Now, do you know what? I mean, Burberry, you know what I'm going to say. When I read that phrase, complete looks, I just thought Daniela Westbrook.
Yeah. It's interesting because Burberry has been a first mover in that it's one of the only, well, it was pretty much the first big fashion house of its kind to move to what they call seasonless collections, which only happened last year. And instead of doing the traditional autumn, winter, spring, summer, they now just have two fashion shows a year and it's just whatever because they're selling into so many territories. The whole spring, summer, autumn, winter just doesn't make sense.
But that's actually the same model that has worked very well for some of the fast fashion guys, particularly
Indeed.
Inditex, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And what happens is they show it traditionally in fashion. You'll have a fashion show and 6 months later it will hit the stores. So you'll show autumn winter in February and it will hit the stores in September. Now what Burberry is doing and what a lot of the fashion industry has been forced to copy is that they show the collection on the runway and you can start to buy it as it comes down the catwalk online.
So presumably these collections are not the sort of insane mad fashion design stuff you occasionally see from some of these houses, but things that are more ready to wear.
They call it wearable.
Wearable.
Wearable fashion.
Wearable. You can actually wear it.
You can actually wear it. Indeed. That is the whole point. The ready-to-wear collections become much more practical. And it is interesting, actually. The last one that I had a look at on Net-a-Porter was very Burberry in that it started to revert very much to the heritage check, which did have such a bad name.
It had a bad name because there was a lot of counterfeiting going on.
Yeah, the licensing got out of control.
But not licensed.
Right.
Unlicensed. Counterfeit that was, you know, the attraction of Burberry was because you had some of these celebrities who were able to afford to go out and buy the look and then people were trying to ape it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a good look.
I mean, they've reinvented it. It's not the same kind of like sort of, you know, associations that it had last time. The interesting thing was when I was doing research for these results, I just went onto the Net-a-Porter site to see what they were selling Burberry items for. And when you're selling a cotton trench coat for like £1,200 and a cardigan for £1,000, to then try and convince your investors that you need to move more upmarket, quote unquote, is going to be quite a tall order, I think. And it seems that Christopher Bailey agrees. I think they've had a clash of strategies because Mr. Gobbetti's only been there since July and Mr. Bailey's already announced his intention to leave.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's very interesting. What do we think about the shares? Which is the most important thing from our perspective?
I actually think the shares are still worth it. They actually trade at a discount now to the sector average. This sort of upper echelon of the fashion industry has been trading at extremely high valuations because of the currency tailwinds most of them are enjoying. But because of this little stumble in the last month or so, the Burberry shares have come off. So for me, it's buy on a dip.
A little buy on opportunity. Indeed, and actually you're sticking with high fashion for your tip this week. We won't reveal the name. Get on the site and have a look when they come out this afternoon. They may have even already come out by the time this gets published. But yeah, you're still thinking there's life in high fashion.
There definitely is, and not to give it away, but the kind of tip that I have done, I mean, it's a very, very different kind of way of operating within the luxury market.
Okay. Shall we, let's head back to the news section. Thank you, Harriet. And talk about Ultra, because this is a company I liked for a long time, but this latest update is horrific. And looking at the 7 days page, it's at the bottom of the table, down 33% in the week till the 14th of November, which is when we calculate the moves. What's happened there, Robbo?
Well, it was basically to do with rationalisation at the MOD, but it's taken a little while to feed through into orders, or lack of orders in this case. And I make the point in this has been coming for some time, but the MOD, according to analysts anyway, have been basically looking at reducing their low-hanging fruit, those types of short-term contracts that can be cancelled readily.
What sort of contract would that be? I mean,
well, stuff that isn't linked to sort of big ticket items. The MOD has
so long. When you say big ticket, you mean sort of long procurement.
Exactly.
Cycles.
The MOD have got a process. They're building a number of new frigates at the moment. We've got the Joint Strike Fighter program. All capital has been committed to these areas, and just given the fact that they're long run, you can't really go back on these commitments as well. So they're just trimming around the margin. Unfortunately, a high proportion of Ultra's revenues are linked to these type of contracts.
You mean the shorter term?
The shorter
duration.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So predominantly short cycle and small ticket procurement is the phrase that's been used.
Because I mean, one of the things I always liked about Ultra was it was really good at doing the sort of buy and build type thing. It bought lots and lots of businesses, broadening its scope, but from the sound of things, that's left it with a bitty nature of what it does, and that's now come to bite.
Yes, it is. But I mean, this has been reflected in markdowns in the lead up to this warning too. So I think the market is reasonably well aware of it.
But it wasn't aware enough for the shares not to fall 30% this week, which is.
No, and actually there had been a sell-off in the week leading up to the announcement as well. I haven't included this in the article, but I did look at some of the figures. So,
but the figure I mentioned is the whole week, not the on the day.
Oh yes, sure. I mean, in the week leading up to the actual announcement itself, there'd been a major sell-off in the shares then. So I don't know if this is something that the regulators would be looking at. I mean, these things have a habit of getting out, and I don't think
they
it
do.
Was. Well, they did update on the Friday prior to the warning as well, saying there is an announcement in the offing.
That so might be the reason.
That could well be the reason. But even
announcing an unscheduled announcement.
But the share price had actually been dropping prior to that as well. I was looking at the midday prices, so I don't know if that's significant at all.
Okay, so cutting to the chase, we bought these shares back in August 2015. They've weakened since then, but you're still positive.
Yeah, I'm reasonably positive because the chief executive designate makes the point that even though we're seeing some weakness in the domestic market, you know, the US defence procurement is on the rise. The adjustment to...
What about some of these sort of emerging market activities? These was, you know, places like India and Brazil were seen as the big future for defence.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't heard that much for the BRICS, really. Saudi Arabia was an important market, but that seemed to have stalled slightly as well. But the big prize is in the United States at the moment.
And we're still comfortable that's there for Ultra to
Yeah, the markdown itself did seem overdone because it was just a 10% reduction in adjusted operating profits they were talking about. And the UK market share is about a quarter at the moment, and I think that's falling. And that includes some starts in nuclear and other industries too. So
Non-defence.
Yeah. I mean, it did seem, the sell-off did seem quite extreme, we thought at the time. It led to the resignation of Rekha Sharma as well. And so obviously the thinking is that the new blood is needed.
When you say new blood, because Douglas Carter, he's been there for years.
Well, he has. He used to be chief executive as well.
Indeed, so, when I covered it, and that was back in 2010.
Yes. But I mean, I think this is a temporary measure. So,
But it may be what the market needs to see. I mean, the man who did actually build this into a very successful kind of aerospace conglomerate, which is what it is, essentially.
Yeah.
You need a bit of experience at the helm, perhaps, is what they want.
It segues into an announcement today as well we've covered for G20 GKN, because the...
I hear the chief execs quit before he's even started.
Well, exactly. Kevin Cummings, he was in charge of their North American aerospace division. This is the one where they've had some problems. And it looks like it's wholly avoidable as well, because it's issues linked to receivables and the balance sheet as well, and inventory issues on the balance sheet. And they had a $15 million or pound write-down announced last month, and that's been brought up to around about a minimum of $80 million. And so this is the division that he was in charge of. So obviously they're thinking, well, it does point to mismanagement.
How did the share price react to this this strange news?
It was down by about 8% last time I looked at it.
Oh, well, never mind.
But, you know, but this is a very good company. And their automotive division has been performing very well, but they've just had problems with the US aerospace.
Robert, let's move away from some of these recent aerospace and automotive disasters. Let's talk about one of your successes in the space, which you've covered in the results section this week, AB Dynamics. They've had another cracking set of results, and the share price is looking much more healthy.
Yeah, there wasn't a great deal within the results that we hadn't been foreshadowed as well, but the interesting point that's made is that a high proportion of next year's revenues are already covered. They've got this marquee deal in China now. The point with it is, we had them on a buy a year or so ago, and the valuations at that point, they were just very hard to sort of to quantify, really, because it's a reasonably large company.
Let's talk about what they do to get an idea of why this company is doing so well.
So basically what they do, it's testing procedures that link to safety and performance with motor vehicles. But they're one of the, I think, three market leaders in this area as well. And innovation and R&D is central to the business model as well. So I make the point that it's a type of company as well that from time to time you're going to find that earnings will oscillate because of the level of capital commitments. I mean, over the last year, for instance, I think that went up eightfold from the previous year, and this is something that investors will have to cope with.
But investing for growth, basically.
Exactly. But the prize is, of course, that they've got this foothold in China. They had been in China before, and they supply services to they don't give an actual list, but we know it's 25 of the 25 largest automakers in the world employ their services. But of course, with the development of electric and hybrid motoring, particularly in China, this will entail a great deal of testing, safety in addition to performance testing, which would be the real driver, I tend to think. So, I mean, this company's set fair for the next 10 years, I would say.
So we're sticking with that view? These are worth hanging on to?
Yeah.
Buying still.
I mean, the original TIP did very well, and we pulled out, and we had...
Run your winners, Robbo. Winners.
I know. It's not the first time this has happened, to be quite honest with you, but we do think this is a long term. It's a cracking company.
Okay. Let's finish off. And there's loads and loads of results in the magazine. Unfortunately, Megan's not around today because she's been in a lot this week. Lots of tech stories.
Yeah, there's a contrasting stories with Vodafone and TalkTalk as well.
Vodafone and TalkTalk on the same page. There's a few bits in the news section. City Fibre. Vodafone again coming together to offer some kind of infrastructure challenge to BT's Openreach division.
Well, the only one that we were aware of so far.
I mean, yeah, indeed. Megan has also talked about, we've got some pharmaceutical news in there as well, about the generics makers, which we're actually going to develop on in the next few weeks or months. ITV, Christmas ads. It's the Christmas ads time of year. Christmas comes earlier every year. It's a good retail story. We're starting to see the beginnings of the Christmas season coming through in some of the results even. Let's talk about Christmas. Should we talk about Christmas ads? I've not seen any.
Well, I had actually a very passive-aggressive tweet sent to me from M&S last week because I tweeted about their Christmas ad.
Was this the bear?
Paddington. I actually thought that their ad beat John Lewis.
What do you mean, beat?
There's a competition, kind of judging. Yeah, obviously. Obviously.
John Lewis has the benefit of a Beatles song in it, albeit sung by
Elbow.
Elbow.
Yeah.
That sounds brilliant.
It's the monster under the bed is the theme of John Lewis versus a classic like Paddington. I just think that's genius.
There've been some complaints about this ad, haven't there?
Well, there's a part in it where people have suspected that not Paddington, but the other character in the
burglar.
The burglar.
The Christmas burglar. That's something everyone wants to associate with Christmas.
It happens, John.
I know, it's happened to me before.
Well, there you go. So
not at Christmas, thankfully.
No. There's a part in it where people are suspecting he's using rather inappropriate language, but he's not.
He is a burglar.
Exactly.
It's the kind of language you would expect, but he didn't say it in a primetime TV ad.
No, he didn't.
Anyway, all this talk about Christmas ads, I don't care. however, I do care about Christmas because it's a big season for retail.
Yeah.
What's happening? What is the kind of warm up? I've seen Christmas trees in pubs.
Yeah, I mean,
Christmas decorations are out in shops.
The thing is,
what's happening
these days? You should care less about Christmas and care more about Black Friday.
Should we care about Black Friday? Robert, you've mentioned this in your Taking Stock column. And I think the point you make, and I agree with this, and I've said this before, it's just bringing a bit of sales forward.
Yeah, so traditionally, the way it even got its name, and I wrote about this last year, actually, was that it was traditionally the first day when retailers in their fourth quarters, if they're working on
in America.
Yeah, on a calendar basis, roughly.
In America.
Went into the black because it was the day after Thanksgiving. Everyone has the day off work and they could go out to the shops and do their Christmas shopping. It was the first time in the sort of final period of the year that the retailers tipped over that mark. That has somehow been distorted in the last few years. And gradually, I think what really changed the game was when Amazon started not only to offer these massive Black Friday deals in the US, but because they're obviously a very international group, they started to offer them on all of their retail websites around the world. And slowly, most of the rest of the domestic retail industry has been forced to play ball as a result.
And it's made its way into the high street as well, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Now we even have Black Friday and Cyber Monday, which are supposed to draw some sort of distinction between physical store sales and online store sales. Of course, the kind of distinction gets a bit lost these days. Although Amazon, I have to say, is very good at making a distinction. It sort of offers different things on different days.
Robert, you're worried that this just encourages retailers to build up inventories.
Yeah.
That cost them money. Holding stock costs businesses money, especially in the retail
sector. Exactly, and if you get these proliferation of one-off events as well, the temptation must be for retailers, right? The opposition's doing it. I've got to sort of build inventory. And what happens if it all goes south?
Which it does for some retailers. They don't get it right.
Well, I read a press release this morning that says, to this day, even though Black Friday has gathered such pace and momentum over the last few years and is now a proper part of the calendar in retail speak, to this day, the only sort of company for which sales hit any kind of record targets is still Amazon.
Just goes to show Amazon, the power is online.
It really
especially
is.
With Amazon.
No other retailer has any kind of record figures to show from it. All in my experience, all they really have to show for it is a diluted margin.
Yeah, absolutely. That's always been my worry about this. Let's talk about B&M because, you know, on the subject of stock build-up, B&M is an interesting company.
It's had an amazing year, which was sort of hinted at in January, and I tipped it very quickly thereafter, and thank God I did because it's up by more than a third after that.
This is a kind of sort of pound shop plus. They're selling essentially goods cheaper than other people can sell them. It's a value retailer.
Yeah, I try less than Poundland. I try and align them more to like a TK Maxx. Outfit. I would say they're less refined than TK Maxx.
But TK Maxx isn't that refined.
No. But in terms of the breadth of the range and the quality that they're trying to strike a note with, I would say it's more aligned to that sort of business. But what has really worked for them this year, which is fascinating, is food retail.
Okay.
That has been the thing they have cited time and again, quarter to quarter, as having massively driven up sales.
But they have, as you say in the piece, bought more stock in advance of Christmas. So this is the risk that we're saying is hanging over retailers right now.
Yeah.
And the high street, I mean, the consumer is not exactly as flush as they were last year. Inflation is is still at 3%, held steady this month, but still 3%, still people are worse off in real terms.
Yeah, and the ONS data this morning, which was the retail sales data for October, it's the worst it has been for 4 years, which some of it was sort of a seasonal weather-inflicted pattern thing, but a lot of it is confidence, and a lot of it is sort of the inflation's rising, household incomes
are under pressure. People are maxed out as well, yeah. We know this. And,
well, wages just aren't keeping pace.
Goes back to your credit cycle point.
Yeah, yeah.
That you've been making for a while, which I think is a very good one. Okay, well, time to keep an eye on obscure accounting measures.
Well, talk about another one
Go on then, Rob. I'll let you have another obscure accounting measure.
Well, just in the... I was talking about retail, but it does extend beyond it. But in terms of retail, we look at inventory turn, but also you need to use the cash conversion cycle in addition to this as well. And I make the point that a retailer like Amazon, for instance, has a negative reading on that, which is highly positive. Highly positive indeed. It means that they don't really have to hold capital on their books, and it puts them in a completely advantageous position to a lot of high street retailers.
Well, they presumably just have buying power. They have power over their suppliers.
Well,
so
exactly.
So if they say to the supplier, "I want you to get that stuff to me tomorrow," and the supplier says, "I can't do it," so Amazon will say, "Well, we're going to screw you on that then."
Well, I do make the point as well that M&S have managed to achieve this negative CCC in the last few years. And I don't know how true this is, but it seemed to me like this points to the food segment increasing in importance throughout. Because obviously, if you're a food retailer, you should be it with a negative CCC.
Always.
Because you don't have to pay dairy farmers for 6 months down the track.
Absolutely.
Or something.
That was always one of the great things about investing in supermarkets, but it's becoming a little bit more difficult.
If Amazon are pushing this and they've got a huge negative CCC as well, what hope is there for conventional retailers?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has been the Amazon threat, which I would say is the dominant narrative of 2017 in retail.
Indeed, it's something we actually did a whole feature on it.
Yeah.
I think it was Alex Newman that wrote that again, wasn't it?
It was. Well, it was Alex. I wrote a bit for it. I think Theron also wrote a bit for it back in the day.
Probably worth having another look at that. I really do think that Amazon is a big threat, not just to retail, but to a number of industries. Definitely go back and have a look at that feature. Have you done your Christmas shopping?
I have done about half of it.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Wow, you are so organised.
I was going to say that's because I'm an organisational freak, and it's not. And we also go away for Christmas, so we tend to have it a bit earlier. But
Robbo, but I know what the answer is.
Oh, I've got some wine in.
Merry Christmas to all.
To be honest, I've given up buying people presents apart from alcohol related presents. So.
Well, for the twins?
No, not for the kids. Actually, I bought them some hot sauce. Only because they're fascinated with my obsession with hot sauce. But there you go. Anyway, I think that's about all we have time for today. There is so much in the magazine this week because results season has really cranked up and there's been a lot of corporate news. We are at numbers 46 and 47 of Philip Ryland's Understanding Investment in 50 Objects, and we've got the final three coming this week. It's a grand finale. John Rosier, our private investor diarist, has updated his portfolio, doing well again. Lots in the personal finance and fund section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow.
LG's Momentum stock screen.
Momentum, Monsters of Momentum.
Mm-hmm.
One of your favourites in there, Harry, Games Workshop.
Yeah.
It's actually one of my favourites.
Well, I'm crossing my fingers for Vita for the year again, because the last time I checked, it was up 155%.
Did you tip that?
Yeah, in February.
Wow. It's a good one. Oh, you mean for the Pants of Power?
Yeah.
You want the Pants of Power?
I want them back. I had them. Yeah. I had them 2 years in a row. I lost them last year, and now I want them back.
We should really wrap this up, but just so you all know, a few years ago, Paddy Power sent me a pair of Paddy Power Y fronts, which have become our sort of Christmas
talisman,
Christmas trophy for the person who has the best performing tip of the year. And you've won this once,
well,
twice?
I've been here 4 years in January. I won it the first 2 years I was here. I lost it last year to Alex, but that's because he had a an oil comeback.
I thought you were going to say he cheated.
No. Well, retail really went through the floor after the referendum, of course.
But you want them back. And your hopes are pinned on Games
Crossing
Workshop.
My fingers. I have no idea. I haven't talked to Algie about where the spreadsheet stands, but my chances are
good. I bet you wouldn't want them back if I won it.
Yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, I can only remember one person actually putting them on. That was Mr. Fitzenegg many years ago.
Okay.
Most people put them on their head.
I'll give them a wash.
Thank you, Harriet. Thank you, Robbo. And thank you all for listening. Rough Guide to Risk, How to Invest in an Uncertain World, on sale in all good news agents. And obviously get online. Or get online and subscribe if you want to read it online. And thank you very much. We'll be back next week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.